The Sociopath Next Door, The Ruthless Versus the Rest of Us, by Martha Stout, Ph.D. Read by Shelley Fraser. Copyright 2005 by Martha Stout. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Martha Stout and the Riverside Literary Agency and was produced in the year 2005 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. For Steve Stout, my brother and the person I think of first when I think of strength of character. The conscience of a people is their power. John Dryden. Author's note. The descriptions in The Sociopath Next Door do not identify individuals. At the very heart of psychotherapy is the precept of confidentiality, and as usual, I have taken the most exacting measures to preserve the privacy of all real persons. All names are fictitious, and all other recognizable features have been changed. Some individuals who appear in the book willingly gave their consent to be anonymously portrayed. In these cases, no information has been included that might in any way identify them. The story in the chapter entitled Groundhog Day is fiction. Otherwise, the people, events, and conversations presented here are taken from my 25-year practice of psychology. However, because of my commitment to confidentiality, the people and circumstances portrayed in these pages are composite in nature. That is to say, each case represents a great many individuals whose characteristics and experiences have been adopted conceptually, carefully altered in their specifics, and combined to form an illustrative character. Any resemblance of such a composite character to any actual person is entirely coincidental. Introduction. Imagine. Minds differ still more than faces. Voltaire. Imagine, if you can, not having a conscience, none at all. No feelings of guilt or remorse, no matter what you do. No limiting sense of concern for the well-being of strangers, friends, or even family members. Imagine no struggles with shame, not a single one in your whole life, no matter what kind of selfish, lazy, harmful, or immoral action you had taken. And pretend that the concept of responsibility is unknown to you, except as a burden others seem to accept without question, like gullible fools. Now add to this strange fantasy the ability to conceal from other people that your psychological makeup is radically different from theirs. Since everyone simply assumes that conscience is universal among human beings, hiding the fact that you are conscience-free is nearly effortless. You are not held back from any of your desires by guilt or shame, and you are never confronted by others for your cold-bloodedness. The ice water in your veins is so bizarre, so completely outside of their personal experience, that they seldom even guess at your condition. In other words, you are completely free of internal restraints, and your unhampered liberty to do just as you please, with no pangs of conscience, is conveniently invisible to the world. You can do anything at all. And still, your strange advantage over the majority of people who are kept in line by their consciences will most likely remain undiscovered. How will you live your life? What will you do with your huge and secret advantage and with the corresponding handicap of other people? Conscience. The answer will depend largely on just what your desires happen to be, because people are not all the same. Even the profoundly unscrupulous are not all the same. Some people, whether they have a conscience or not, favor the ease of inertia, while others are filled with dreams and wild ambitions. Some human beings are brilliant and talented, some are dull-witted, and most, conscience or not, are somewhere in between. There are violent people and non-violent ones, individuals who are motivated by bloodlust, and those who have no such appetites. Maybe you are someone who craves money and power, and though you have no vestige of conscience, you do have a magnificent IQ. You have the driving nature and the intellectual capacity to pursue tremendous wealth and influence, and you are in no way moved by the nagging voice of conscience that prevents other people from doing everything and anything they have to do to succeed. You choose business, politics, the law, banking, or international development, or any of a broad array of other power professions, and you pursue your career with a cold passion that tolerates none of the usual moral or legal encumbrances. When it is expedient, you doctor the accounting and shred the evidence. You stab your employees and your clients, or your constituency, in the back. Marry for money. Tell lethal, premeditated lies to people who trust you. Attempt to ruin colleagues who are powerful or eloquent, and simply steamroll over groups who are dependent and voiceless. And all of this you do with the exquisite freedom that results from having no conscience whatsoever. You become unimaginably, unassailably, and maybe even globally successful. Why not? With your big brain and no conscience to rein in your schemes, you can do anything at all. Or no, let us say you are not quite such a person. You are ambitious, yes, and in the name of success, you are willing to do all manner of things that people with conscience would never consider. But you are not an intellectually gifted individual. Your intelligence is above average, perhaps, and people think of you as smart, maybe even very smart. But you know in your heart of hearts that you do not have the cognitive wherewithal or the creativity to reach the careening heights of power you secretly dream about, and this makes you resentful of the world at large and envious of the people around you. As this sort of person, you ensconce yourself in a niche, or maybe a series of niches, in which you can have some amount of control over small numbers of people. These situations satisfy a little of your desire for power, although you are chronically aggravated at not having more. It chafes to be so free of the ridiculous inner voice that inhibits others from achieving great power without having enough talent to pursue the ultimate successes yourself. Sometimes you fall into sulky, rageful moods caused by a frustration that no one but you understands. But you do enjoy jobs that afford you a certain under-supervised control over a few individuals or small groups, preferably people in groups who are relatively helpless or in some way vulnerable. You are a teacher or a psychotherapist, a divorce lawyer or a high school coach. Or maybe you are a consultant of some kind, a broker, or a gallery owner, or a human services director. Or maybe you do not have a paid position and are instead the president of your condominium association, or a volunteer hospital worker, or a parent. Whatever your job, you manipulate and bully the people who are under your thumb as often and as outrageously as you can without getting fired or held accountable. You do this for its own sake, even when it serves no purpose except to give you a thrill. Making people jump means you have power, or this is the way you see it, and bullying provides you with an adrenaline rush. It is fun. Maybe you cannot be the CEO of a multinational corporation, but you can frighten a few people, or cause them to scurry around like chickens, or steal from them, or, maybe best of all, create situations that cause them to feel bad about themselves. And this is power, especially when the people you manipulate are superior to you in some way. Most invigorating of all is to bring down people who are smarter or more accomplished than you, or perhaps classier, more attractive, or popular, or morally admirable. This is not only good fun, it is existential vengeance, and without a conscience, it is amazingly easy to do. You quietly lie to the boss or to the boss's boss, cry some crocodile tears, or sabotage a coworker's project, or gaslight a patient or a child, bait people with promises, or provide a little misinformation that will never be traced back to you. Or now, let us say you are a person who has a proclivity for violence or for seeing violence done. You can simply murder your coworker or have her murdered, or your boss, or your ex-spouse, or your wealthy lover's spouse, or anyone else who bothers you. You have to be careful, because if you slip up, you may be caught and punished by the system, but you will never be confronted by your conscience, because you have no conscience. If you decide to kill, the only difficulties will be the external ones. Nothing inside of you will ever protest. Provided you are not forcibly stopped, you can do anything at all. If you are born at the right time, with some access to family fortune, and you have a special talent for whipping up other people's hatred and sense of deprivation, you can arrange to kill large numbers of unsuspecting people. With enough money, you can accomplish this from far away, and you can sit back safely and watch in satisfaction. In fact, Terrorism, done from a distance, is the ideal occupation for a person who is possessed of bloodlust and no conscience, because if you do it just right, you may be able to make a whole nation jump. And if that is not power, what is? Or let us imagine the opposite extreme. You have no interest in power. To the contrary, you are the sort of person who really does not want much of anything. Your only real ambition is not to have to exert yourself to get by. You do not want to work like everyone else does. Without a conscience, you can nap or pursue your hobbies or watch television or just hang out somewhere all day long. Living a bit on the fringes and with some handouts from relatives and friends, you can do this indefinitely. People may whisper to one another that you are an underachiever or that you are depressed, a sad case, or, in contrast, if they get angry, they may grumble that you are lazy. When they get to know you better and get really angry, they may scream at you and call you a loser, a bum. But it will never occur to them that you literally do not have a conscience, that in such a fundamental way, your very mind is not the same as theirs. The panicked feeling of a guilty conscience never squeezes at your heart or wakes you up in the middle of the night. Despite your lifestyle, you never feel irresponsible, neglectful, or so much as embarrassed, although for the sake of appearances, sometimes you pretend that you do. For example, if you are a decent observer of people and what they react to, you may adopt a lifeless facial expression, say how ashamed of your life you are, and talk about how rotten you feel. This you do only because it is more convenient to have people think you are depressed than it is to have them shouting at you all the time or insisting that you get a job. You notice that people who do have a conscience feel guilty when they harangue someone they believe to be depressed or troubled. As a matter of fact, to your further advantage, they often feel obliged to take care of such a person. If, despite your relative poverty, you can manage to get yourself into a sexual relationship with someone, this person, who does not suspect what you are really like, may feel particularly obligated. And since all you want is not to have to work, your financier does not have to be especially rich, just reliably conscience-bound. I trust that imagining yourself as any of these people feels insane to you, because such people are insane, dangerously so. Insane, but real. They even have a label. Many mental health professionals refer to the condition of little or no conscience as antisocial personality disorder, a non-correctable disfigurement of character that is now thought to be present in about 4% of the population, that is to say, 1 in 25 people. This condition of missing conscience is called by other names too, most often sociopathy, or the somewhat more familiar term, psychopathy. Guiltlessness was in fact the first personality disorder to be recognized by psychiatry, and terms that have been used at times over the past century include manie sans douleur, psychopathic inferiority, moral insanity, and moral imbecility. According to the current Bible of Psychiatric Labels, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders 4 of the American Psychiatric Association, the clinical diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder should be considered when an individual possesses at least 3 of the following 7 characteristics. 1. Failure to conform to social norms. 2. Deceitfulness, manipulativeness. 3. Impulsivity, failure to plan ahead. 4. Irritability, aggressiveness. 5. Reckless disregard for the safety of self or others. 6. Consistent irresponsibility. 7. Lack of remorse after having hurt, mistreated, or stolen from another person. The presence in an individual of any 3 of these symptoms taken together is enough to make many psychiatrists suspect the disorder. Other researchers and clinicians, many of whom think the APA's definition describes simply criminality better than true psychopathy or sociopathy, point to additional documented characteristics of sociopaths as a group. One of the more frequently observed of these traits is a glib and superficial charm that allows the true sociopath to seduce other people, figuratively or literally. A kind of glow or charisma that initially can make the sociopath seem more charming or more interesting than most of the normal people around him. He or she is more spontaneous, or more intense, or somehow more complex, or sexier, or more entertaining than everyone else. Sometimes this sociopathic charisma is accompanied by a grandiose sense of self-worth that may be compelling at first, but upon closer inspection may seem odd or perhaps laughable. Someday the world will realize how special I am, or, you know that after me, no other lover will do. In addition, sociopaths have a greater than normal need for stimulation, which results in their taking frequent social, physical, financial, or legal risks. Characteristically, they can charm others into attempting dangerous ventures with them, and as a group, they are known for their pathological lying and conning, and their parasitic relationships with friends. Regardless of how educated or highly placed as adults, they may have a history of early behavior problems, sometimes including drug use or recorded juvenile delinquency, and always including a failure to acknowledge responsibility for any problems that occurred. And sociopaths are noted especially for their shallowness of emotion, the hollow and transient nature of any affectionate feelings they may claim to have, a certain breathtaking callousness. They have no trace of empathy and no genuine interest in bonding emotionally with a mate. Once the surface charm is scraped off, their marriages are loveless, one-sided, and almost always short-term. If a marriage partner has any value to the sociopath, it is because the partner is viewed as a possession, one that the sociopath may feel angry to lose, but never sad or accountable. All of these characteristics, along with the symptoms listed by the American Psychiatric Association, are the behavioral manifestations of what is for most of us an unfathomable psychological condition, the absence of our essential seventh sense, conscience. Crazy and frightening, and real, in about 4% of the population. But what does 4% really mean to society? As points of reference to problems we hear about more often, consider the following statistics. The prevalence rate for anorexic eating disorders is estimated at 3.43%, deemed to be nearly epidemic, and yet this figure is a fraction lower than the rate for antisocial personality. The high-profile disorders, classed as schizophrenia, occur in only about 1% of us, a mere quarter of the rate of antisocial personality. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say that the rate of colon cancer in the United States, considered alarmingly high, is about 40 per 100,000, 100 times lower than the rate of antisocial personality. Put more succinctly, there are more sociopaths among us than people who suffer from the much-publicized disorder of anorexia, 4 times as many sociopaths as schizophrenics, and 100 times as many sociopaths as people diagnosed with a known scourge such as colon cancer. As a therapist, I specialize in the treatment of psychological trauma survivors. Over the past 25 years, my practice has included hundreds of adults who have been in psychological pain every day of their lives on account of early childhood abuse or some other horrendous past experience. As I have detailed in case studies in The Myth of Sanity, my trauma patients suffer from a host of torments, including chronic anxiety, incapacitating depression, and dissociative mental states. And, feeling that their time on Earth was unbearable, many of them have come to me after recovering from attempts to commit suicide. Some have been traumatized by natural and man-made disasters, such as earthquakes and wars, but most of them have been controlled and psychologically shattered by individual human perpetrators, often sociopaths, sometimes sociopathic strangers, but more typically sociopathic parents, older relatives, or siblings. In helping my patients and their families cope with the harm done to their lives and in studying their case histories, I have learned that the damage caused by the sociopaths among us is deep and lasting, often tragically lethal, and startlingly common. Working with hundreds of survivors, I have become convinced that dealing openly and directly with the facts about sociopathy is a matter of urgency for us all. About 1 in 25 individuals are sociopathic, meaning essentially that they do not have a conscience, It is not that this group fails to grasp the difference between good and bad. It is that the distinction fails to limit their behavior. The intellectual difference between right and wrong does not bring on the emotional sirens and flashing blue lights, or the fear of God that it does for the rest of us. Without the slightest blip of guilt or remorse, 1 in 25 people can do anything at all. The high incidence of sociopathy in human society has a profound effect on the rest of us who must live on this planet too, even those of us who have not been clinically traumatized. The individuals who constitute this 4% drain our relationships, our bank accounts, our accomplishments, our self-esteem, our very peace on Earth. Yet surprisingly, many people know nothing about this disorder, or if they do, they think only in terms of violent psychopathy, murderers, serial killers, mass murderers, people who have conspicuously broken the law many times over, and who, if caught, will be imprisoned, maybe even put to death by our legal system. We are not commonly aware of, nor do we usually identify, the larger number of nonviolent sociopaths among us, people who often are not blatant lawbreakers and against whom our formal legal system provides little defense. Most of us would not imagine any correspondence between conceiving an ethnic genocide and, say, guiltlessly lying to one's boss about a coworker. But the psychological correspondence is not only there, it is chilling. Simple and profound, the link is the absence of the inner mechanism that beats up on us, emotionally speaking, when we make a choice we view as immoral, unethical, neglectful, or selfish. Most of us feel mildly guilty if we eat the last piece of cake in the kitchen, let alone what we would feel if we intentionally and methodically set about to hurt another person. Those who have no conscience at all are a group unto themselves, whether they be homicidal tyrants or merely ruthless social snipers. The presence or absence of conscience is a deep human division, arguably more significant than intelligence, race, or even gender. What differentiates a sociopath who lives off the labors of others from one who occasionally robs convenience stores, or from one who is a contemporary robber baron, or what makes the difference between an ordinary bully and a sociopathic murderer is nothing more than social status, drive, intellect, bloodlust, or simple opportunity. What distinguishes all of these people from the rest of us is an utterly empty hole in the psyche, where there should be the most evolved of all humanizing functions. For something like 96% of us, conscience is so fundamental that we seldom even think about it. For the most part, it acts like a reflex. Unless temptation is extremely great, which thankfully on a day-to-day basis it usually is not, we by no means reflect on each and every moral question that comes our way. We do not seriously ask ourselves, shall I give my child lunch money today or not? Shall I steal my coworker's briefcase today or not? Shall I walk out on my spouse today or not? Conscience makes all of these decisions for us, so quietly, automatically, and continually, that in our most creative flights of imagination, we would not be able to conjure the image of an existence without conscience. And so, naturally, when someone makes a truly conscienceless choice, all we can produce are explanations that come nowhere near the truth. She forgot to give lunch money to her child. That person's coworker must have misplaced her briefcase. That person's spouse must have been impossible to live with. Or we come up with labels that, provided we do not inspect too closely, almost explain another person's antisocial behavior. He is eccentric or artistic, or really competitive, or lazy or clueless, or always such a rogue. Except for the psychopathic monsters we sometimes see on television, whose actions are too horrific to explain away, conscienceless people are nearly always invisible to us. We are keenly interested in how smart we are and in the intelligence level of other people. The smallest child can tell the difference between a girl and a boy. We fight wars over race. But as to what is possibly the single most meaningful characteristic that divides the human species, the presence or absence of conscience, we remain effectively oblivious. Very few people, no matter how educated they are in other ways, know the meaning of the word sociopathic. Far less do they understand that, in all probability, the word could be properly applied to a handful of people they actually know. And even after we have learned the label for it, being devoid of conscience is impossible for most human beings to fantasize about. In fact, it is difficult to think of another experience that quite so eludes empathy. Total blindness, clinical depression, profound cognitive deficit, winning the lottery, and a thousand other extremes of human experience, even psychosis, are accessible to our imaginations. We have all been lost in the dark. We have all been somewhat depressed. We have all felt stupid, at least once or twice. Most of us have made the mental list of what we would do with a windfall fortune. And in our dreams at night, our thoughts and our images are deranged. But not to care at all about the effects of our actions on society, on friends, on family, on our children? What on earth would that be like? What would we do with ourselves? Nothing in our lives, waking or sleeping, informs us. The closest we come, perhaps, is the experience of being in so much physical pain that our ability to reason or act is temporarily paralyzed. But even in pain, there is guilt. Absolute guiltlessness defies the imagination. Conscience is our omniscient taskmaster, setting the rules for our actions and meting out emotional punishments when we break the rules. We never ask for conscience. It is just there all the time, like skin or lungs or heart. In a manner of speaking, we cannot even take credit, and we cannot imagine what we would feel like without it. Guiltlessness is uniquely confusing as a medical concept, too, quite unlike cancer, anorexia, schizophrenia, depression, or even the other character disorders, such as narcissism. Sociopathy would seem to have a moral aspect. Sociopaths are almost invariably seen as bad or diabolical, even by, or perhaps especially by, mental health professionals. And the sentiment that these patients are somehow morally offensive and scary comes across vividly in the literature. Robert Hare, a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia, has developed an inventory called the Psychopathy Checklist, now accepted as a standard diagnostic instrument for researchers and clinicians worldwide. Of his subjects, Hare, the dispassionate scientist, writes, "Everyone, including the experts, can be taken in, manipulated, conned, and left bewildered by them. A good psychopath can play a concerto on anyone's heartstrings. Your best defense is to understand the nature of these human predators." And Hervey Cleckney, author of the 1941 classic text, The Mask of Sanity, makes this complaint of the psychopath. "Beauty and ugliness, except in a very superficial sense, goodness, evil, love, horror, and humor, have no actual meaning, no power to move him." The argument can easily be made that sociopathy and antisocial personality disorder and psychopathy are misnomers, reflecting an unstable mix of ideas, and that the absence of conscience does not really make sense as a psychiatric category in the first place. In this regard, it is crucial to note that all of the other psychiatric diagnoses, including narcissism, involve some amount of personal distress or misery for the individuals who suffer from them. Sociopathy stands alone as a disease that causes no disease for the person who has it, no subjective discomfort. Sociopaths are often quite satisfied with themselves and with their lives, and perhaps for this very reason there is no effective treatment. Typically, sociopaths enter therapy only when they have been court-referred or when there is some secondary gain to be had from being a patient. Wanting to get better is seldom the true issue. All of this begs the question of whether the absence of conscience is a psychiatric disorder or a legal designation, or something else altogether. Singular in its ability to unnerve even seasoned professionals, the concept of sociopathy comes perilously close to our notions of the soul, of evil versus good, and this association makes the topic difficult to think about clearly. and the unavoidable them versus us nature of the problem raises scientific, moral, and political issues that boggle the mind. How does one scientifically study a phenomenon that appears to be, in part, a moral one? Who should receive our professional help and support, the patients or the people who must endure them? Since psychological research is generating ways to diagnose sociopathy, whom should we test? Should anyone be tested for such a thing in a free society? And if someone has been clearly identified as a sociopath, what, if anything, can society do with that information? No other diagnosis raises such politically and professionally incorrect questions, and sociopathy, with its known relationship to behaviors ranging from spouse battering and rape to serial murder and warmongering, is in some sense the last and most frightening psychological frontier. Indeed, the most unnerving questions are seldom even whispered. Can we say for sure that sociopathy does not work for the individual who has it? Is sociopathy a disorder at all, or is it functional? Just as unwelcome is the uncertainty on the flip side of that coin. Does conscience work for the individual or group who has it? Or is conscience, as more than one sociopath has implied, simply a psychological corral for the masses? Whether we speak them out loud or not, doubts like these implicitly loom large on a planet where for thousands of years, and right up to the present moment, the most universally famous names have always belonged to those who could manage to be amoral on a large enough scale. And in our present-day culture, using other people has become almost trendy, and unconscionable business practices appear to yield unlimited wealth. On a personal level, most of us have examples from our own lives in which someone unscrupulous has won, and there are times when having integrity begins to feel like merely playing the fool. Is it the case that cheaters never prosper? Or is it true, after all, that nice guys finish last? Will the shameless minority really inherit the earth? Such questions reflect a central concern of this book, a theme that occurred to me just after the catastrophes of September 11, 2001, propelled all people of conscience into anguish, and some into despair. I am usually an optimistic person, but at that time, along with a number of other psychologists and students of human nature, I feared that my country and many others would fall into hate-filled conflicts and vengeful wars that would preoccupy us for many years to come. From nowhere, a line from a 30-year-old apocalyptic song invaded my thoughts whenever I tried to relax or sleep. Satan, laughing, spread his wings. The winged Satan, in my mind's eye, roared with cynical laughter, and rising from the wreckage was not a terrorist, but a demonic manipulator who used the terrorists' acts to ignite the kindling of hatred all over the globe. I became interested in my particular topic of sociopathy versus conscience during a phone conversation with a colleague of mine, a good man who is normally upbeat and full of encouragement, but who was at that moment stunned and demoralized along with the rest of the world. We were discussing a mutual patient whose suicidal symptoms had become alarmingly worse, apparently on account of the disasters in the United States, and who has improved a great deal since then, I am relieved to report. My colleague was saying how guilty he felt because he was torn apart himself and might not have the usual amount of emotional energy to give to the patient. This extraordinarily caring and responsible therapist, overwhelmed by events like everyone else, believed he was being remiss. In the middle of judging himself, he stopped, sighed, and said to me in a very weary voice, highly uncharacteristic of him, "You know, sometimes I wonder, why have a conscience? It just puts you on the losing team." I was very much taken aback by his question, mostly because cynicism was so unlike this man's usual hale and hearty frame of mind. After a moment, I replied with another question. I said, "So tell me, Bernie, if you had a choice, I mean really literally had a choice in the matter, which you don't, of course, would you choose to have a conscience like you do? Or would you prefer to be sociopathic and capable of, well, anything at all?" He considered this and said, "You're right, although I had not meant to imply telepathy. I choose to have a conscience." "Why?" I pressed him. There was a pause and then a long drawn-out, "Well..." Finally he said, "You know, Martha, I don't know why. I just know I'd choose conscience." And maybe I was thinking too wishfully, but it seemed to me that after he made this statement, there was a subtle change in Bernie's voice. He sounded slightly less defeated, and we started to talk about what one of our professional organizations planned to do for the people in New York and Washington. After that conversation, and for a very long time, I remained intrigued by my colleague's question, "Why have a conscience?" and by his preference to be conscience-bound rather than conscience-free, and by the fact that he did not know why he would make this choice. A moralist or a theologian might well have answered, "Because it's right," or "Because I want to be a good person." But my friend the psychologist could not give a psychological answer. I feel strongly that we need to know the psychological reason. Especially now, in a world that seems ready to self-destruct with global business scams, terrorism, and wars of hatred, we need to hear why, in a psychological sense, being a person of conscience is preferable to being a person unfettered by guilt or remorse. In part, this book is my answer as a psychologist to that question, "Why have a conscience?" To get to the reasons, I first discuss people who are without conscience, the sociopaths, how they behave, how they feel, so that we can look more meaningfully into the value, for the other 96% of us, of possessing a trait that can be aggravating, painful, and, yes, it is true, limiting. What follows is a psychologist's celebration of the still small voice and of the great majority of human beings who find themselves graced with a conscience. It is a book for those of us who cannot imagine any other way to live. The book is also my attempt to warn good people about the sociopath next door and to help them cope. As a psychologist and as a person, I have seen far too many lives nearly obliterated by the choices and acts of a conscienceless few. These few are both dangerous and remarkably difficult to identify. Even when they are not physically violent, and especially when they are familiar and close to us, they are all too capable of mangling individual lives and of making human society as a whole an unsafe place to be. To my mind, this dominance over the rest of us by people who have no conscience at all constitutes an especially widespread and appalling example of what novelist F. Scott Fitzgerald referred to as the tyranny of the weak. And I believe that all people of conscience should learn what the everyday behavior of these people looks like so they can recognize and deal effectively with the morally weak and the ruthless. Where conscience is concerned, we seem to be a species of extremes. We have only to turn on our televisions to see this bewildering dichotomy, to encounter images of people on their hands and knees rescuing a puppy from a drainage pipe, followed by reports of other human beings slaughtering women and children and stacking the corpses. And in our ordinary daily lives, though perhaps not so dramatically, we see the contrasts just as plentifully. In the morning, someone cheerfully goes out of her way to hand us the $10 bill that we dropped, and in the afternoon, another person, grinning, goes out of his way to cut us off in traffic. Given the radically contradictory behavior we witness every day, we must talk openly about both extremes of human personality and behavior. To create a better world, we need to understand the nature of people who routinely act against the common good and who do so with emotional impunity. Only by seeking to discover the nature of ruthlessness can we find the many ways people can triumph over it, and only by recognizing the dark can we make a genuine affirmation of the light. It is my hope that this book will play some part in limiting the sociopath's destructive impact on our lives. As individuals, people of conscience can learn to recognize the sociopath next door, and with that knowledge, work to defeat his entirely self-interested aims. At the very least, they can protect themselves and their loved ones from his shameless maneuverings. Chapter 1. The Seventh Sense. Virtue is not the absence of vices or the avoidance of moral dangers. Virtue is a vivid and separate thing, like pain or a particular smell. G.K. Chesterton. This morning, Joe, a 33-year-old attorney, is running 5 minutes late for an extremely important meeting that, with or without him, will start promptly at 8 o'clock. He needs to keep up a good impression with the more senior members of his firm, which means just about everybody, and he would like to have the first word with these wealthy clients, whose concerns include Joe's budding specialty of estate planning. He has been preparing his agenda for days because he feels there's a lot at stake, and he very much wants to be in the conference room at the start of the meeting. Unfortunately, the furnace in Joe's townhouse suddenly stopped making heat in the middle of the night. Freezing and pacing, afraid the pipes would burst, he had to wait for the emergency repairman from the fuel company before he could leave for work this morning. When the man showed up, Joe let him in and then, desperate to get to the meeting, abandoned him in the townhouse to fix the furnace, hoping the fellow would prove reasonably honest. At last, Joe was able to race to his Audi and set off for the office, but with only 25 minutes left to make a 30-minute drive. He resolved to bend the rules a little and make up the time. Now Joe is speeding along a familiar route to work, clenching his teeth and swearing under his breath at the slow drivers, at all the drivers, really. He reinterprets a couple of red lights, passes a line of traffic by using the breakdown lane, and clings frantically to the hope that he can somehow make it to the office by 8. When he hits 3 green lights in a row, he thinks that he may just succeed. With his right hand, he reaches over to touch the overnight bag in the passenger seat to reassure himself that he remembered to bring it. In addition to everything else, he has to catch a 10:15 plane to New York this morning, a trip for the firm, and there will certainly not be time after the meeting to go back home for his things. His hand contacts the cushiony leather of the bag. It is there and packed. And at this very moment, Joe remembers. He forgot to feed Reebok. Reebok is Joe's 3-year-old blonde Labrador retriever, so named because, before he got too busy at the firm, Joe used to take early morning runs with his enthusiastic new pet. When work took over and the morning routine changed, Joe fenced in the small backyard and installed a doggy door in the basement, allowing the dog solo access to the outside. At this point, runs together in the park are weekends only, but exercise or not, Reebok consumes several pounds of science diet every week, along with a huge assortment of leftover human food and at least one full box of jumbo bone treats. The young dog's appetite is stupendous, and he seems to live quite happily for 2 pleasures alone, his time with Joe and his food. Joe got Reebok as a puppy because when Joe was a boy, his father would not let him have a pet, and he had vowed to himself that when he was grown up and successful, he would have a dog, a big one. At first, Reebok had not been very different from the Audi, another acquisition, a marker of Joe's independence and material prosperity, but soon Joe had fallen in love with the animal himself. How could he not? Reebok adored Joe unconditionally, and from puppyhood had followed him around the house as if Joe were the center of all that was good in the universe. As his puppy grew to doghood, Joe realized that this creature had as distinct and individual personality as any human being, and that his liquid brown eyes contained at least as much soul. Now, whenever Joe looks into those eyes, Reebok wrinkles his soft beige brow into several folded carpet furrows and stares back. In this way, the sweet, ungainly dog appears preternaturally thoughtful, as if he can read Joe's mind and is concerned. Sometimes, when there is a business trip, like today, Joe is gone from home for a day and a half, or even a little longer, and each time he comes back, Reebok greets him at the door with bounding joy and instantaneous forgiveness. Before he takes one of these trips, Joe always leaves large mixing bowls of food and water for Reebok to consume in his absence, which Reebok does easily. But this time, between the furnace problem and his panic about the 8 o'clock meeting, Joe forgot. The dog has no food and maybe even no water and no way to get any until tomorrow evening when Joe returns from his trip. Maybe I can call someone to help out, Joe thinks desperately. But no, he's between girlfriends at present, and so no one has a key to his house. The impossibility of his situation begins to dawn on him, and he grips the steering wheel even harder. He absolutely must make this meeting, and he can be there on time if he just keeps going. But what about Reebok? He will not starve to death in a day and a half, Joe knows, but he will be miserable. And the water, how long does it take an animal to die of dehydration? Joe has no idea. Still driving as fast as the traffic will bear, he tries to think about his options. The available choices tumble over one another in a rush. He can attend the 8 o'clock meeting and then go home and feed the dog, but that will make him miss his 10:15 flight, and the trip is even more important than the meeting. He can go to the meeting and leave in the middle. No, that would be seen as offensive. He can try to get a later flight, but then he will be very late for his appointment in New York, may even miss it entirely, which could cost him his job. He can ignore the dog until tomorrow. He can turn around now, miss the 8 o'clock meeting at the firm, take care of the dog, and still make it to the airport for his 10:15 flight. Like a man in pain, Joe moans loudly and slumps in his seat. Just a few blocks from work, he pulls the car into a spot marked construction only, dials the office on his cell phone, and tells the secretary to inform those at the morning meeting that he will not be attending. He turns the car around and goes home to feed Reebok. What is conscience? Amazingly, from a certain point of view, the human being we are calling Joe decides to be absent from an important meeting with some wealthy clients, an event he has spent several days planning for, and where his personal interests quite clearly reside. At first, he does everything he can to get to the meeting on time, risking all the possessions in his townhouse to a repairman he has never met before, and his own physical safety in his car. And then, at the very last minute, he turns around and goes home to feed a dog, a guileless, wordless creature who could not even so much as reprove Joe for ignoring him. Joe sacrifices a high-stakes desire of his own in favor of an action that no one will witness, except maybe the repairman, a choice that will not enrich him by even one penny. What could possibly cause a young, ambitious lawyer to do such a thing? Most readers will smile a little when Joe turns his car around. We feel pleased with him for going back to feed his dog. But why are we pleased? Is Joe acting out of conscience? Is this what we mean when we make an approving remark about someone's behavior, such as, his conscience stopped him? What is this invisible, inescapable, frustratingly incorruptible part of us we call conscience anyway? The question is a complicated one, even as it pertains to the simple vignette about Joe and Reebok, because surprisingly there are a number of motivations, other than conscience, that, separately or together, might cause Joe, might cause any of us, to make an apparently self-sacrificing choice. For example, perhaps Joe simply cannot stomach the thought of returning from his New York trip to find a Labrador retriever dehydrated and dead on his kitchen floor. Not knowing how long a dog can survive without water, he is unwilling to take the risk, but his aversion to the horrifying scenario is not exactly conscience. It is something more like revulsion or fear. Or maybe Joe is motivated by what the neighbors will think if they hear Reebok howling in hunger, or worse, if they learn the dog has died alone and trapped while Joe was on a business trip. How will he ever explain himself to his friends and acquaintances? This worry is not really Joe's conscience either, but rather his anticipation of serious embarrassment and social rejection. If this is why Joe goes back home to feed his dog, he is hardly the first human being to make a decision based on the dread of what others will think of him, rather than on what he might do if he were sure his actions would remain a complete secret. The opinions of other people keep us all in line, arguably better than anything else. Or maybe this is all a matter of the way Joe sees himself. Perhaps Joe does not want to view himself, in his own mind's eye, as the kind of wretch who would commit animal abuse, and his self-image as a decent person is crucial enough to him that, when he has no other alternative, he will forego an important meeting in the service of preserving that image. This is an especially plausible explanation for Joe's behavior. The preservation of self-image is a motivator of some notoriety. In literature, and often in historical accounts of human action, dedication to one's own self-regard is referred to as honor. Lives have been forfeited, wars have been fought over honor. It is an ancient concern, and in the modern field of psychology, how we view ourselves translates to the newer concept of self-esteem, a subject about which more psychology books have been written than perhaps any other single topic. Maybe Joe is willing to relinquish a few career points today in order to feel okay when he looks at himself in the mirror tomorrow, in order to remain honorable in his own eyes. That would be laudable and very human, but it is not conscience. The intriguing truth of the matter is that much of what we do that looks like conscience is motivated by some other thing altogether. Fear, social pressure, pride, even simple habit. And where Joe is concerned, a number of readers will strongly favor an explanation other than conscience because some of his behaviors are already questionable. He routinely leaves his young dog alone for many hours at a time, sometimes for nearly 2 days. This very morning, though he is skipping his meeting and going home to feed the dog, he still intends to make that 10:15 flight and be gone until the following evening. Reebok will have no one to be with and nowhere to go except a small fenced-in backyard. Consigning a dog to such a situation is not very nice. It reflects, at best, a certain lack of empathy on Joe's part for the animal's social needs. Still, truth to tell, being nice would not necessarily be conscience either. For brief periods, any reasonably clever sociopath can act with saint-like niceness for his own manipulative purposes. And people who do possess conscience are often unkind despite themselves, out of ignorance or, as in Joe's case perhaps, inadequate empathy or just run-of-the-mill psychological denial. Nice behavior, prudent action, thoughts about how other people will react to us, honorable conduct in the interest of our self-regard. Like conscience, all of these have a positive effect on the world, at least most of the time, and any or all of them might get the dog fed sometimes, but none can be defined as the individual's conscience. This is because conscience is not a behavior at all, not something that we do or even something that we think or mull over. Conscience is something that we feel. In other words, conscience is neither behavioral nor cognitive. Conscience exists primarily in the realm of affect, better known as emotion. To clarify this distinction, let us take another look at Joe. He is not always nice to his dog, but does he have a conscience? What evidence would cause, say, a psychologist to decide that when Joe passed up his meeting and went home to rescue Reebok, he was acting out of conscience, rather than because of what other people would think, or to preserve his own self-image, or maybe from the noteworthy financial consideration that 3 years before he had paid $1,200 for a purebred Labrador puppy guaranteed against hip dysplasia and heart disease? As a psychologist, I am persuaded most by a feature of the story we have not even addressed until now, the fact that Joe feels affection for Reebok. He is emotionally attached to his dog. Reebok follows Joe around the house, and Joe likes it. Joe gazes into Reebok's eyes. Reebok has changed Joe from a trophy pet owner to a smitten pet owner. And on account of this attachment, I believe that when Joe gave up his morning plan and went home to take care of his dog, he may possibly have been acting out of conscience. If we could give Joe a truth serum and ask him what was going on inside him at the moment he decided to turn the car around, and he were to say something like, "I just couldn't stand it that Reebok was going to be there hungry and thirsty all that time," then I would be reasonably convinced that Joe was conscience-driven in this situation. I would be basing my evaluation of Joe on the psychology of conscience itself. Psychologically speaking, conscience is a sense of obligation, ultimately based in an emotional attachment to another living creature, often, but not always, a human being, or to a group of human beings, or even in some cases to humanity as a whole. Conscience does not exist without an emotional bond to someone or something. And in this way, conscience is closely allied with the spectrum of emotions we call love. This alliance is what gives true conscience its resilience and its astonishing authority over those who have it, and probably also its confusing and frustrating quality. Conscience can motivate us to make seemingly irrational and even self-destructive decisions, from the trivial to the heroic, from missing an 8 o'clock meeting to remaining silent under torture for the love of one's country. It can drive us in this way only because its fuel is none other than our strongest affections. And witnessing or hearing about an act of conscience, even one as ordinary as feeding a dog, pleases us, because any conscience-bound choice reminds us of the sweet ties that bind. A story about conscience is a story about the connectedness of living things, and in unconscious recognition we smile at the true nature of the tale. We understand how excruciating Joe's feelings are as he struggles with his conscience, and we smile at Joe and Reebok, because we always smile at lovers. The History of Conscience. Not everyone has a conscience, this intervening sense of obligation based in our emotional attachments to others. Some people will never experience the exquisite angst that results from letting others down, or hurting them, or depriving them, or even killing them. If the first five senses are the physical ones, sight, hearing, touch, smell, taste, and the sixth sense is how we refer to our intuition, then conscience can be numbered seventh at best. It developed later in the evolution of our species and is still far from universal. To make matters murkier, in the day-to-day course of our lives, we are usually unable to tell the difference between those who possess conscience and those who do not. Could an ambitious young lawyer conceivably have a seventh sense? Yes, conceivably. Could a mother of several young children have a seventh sense? Of course she could. Could a priest, charged with the spiritual welfare of an entire community, be conscience-bound? Let us hope so. Could the powerful political leader of a whole nation of people have a conscience? Certainly. Or, contrastingly, could any of these people be utterly without conscience? The answer is, once again, unnervingly, yes. The anonymity of evil and its maddening refusal to attach itself reliably to any particular societal role, racial group, or physical type has always plagued theologians, and, more recently, scientists. Throughout human history, we have tried mightily to pin down good and evil, and to find some way to account for those in our midst who would seem to be inhabited by the latter. In the 4th century, the Christian scholar St. Jerome introduced the Greek word synderesis to describe the innate God-given ability to sense the difference between good and evil. He interpreted Ezekiel's biblical vision of 4 living creatures emerging from a cloud with brightness round about it and fire flashing forth continually. Each creature had the body of a man, but each had 4 different faces. The face in front was human, the face on the right was that of a lion, the left face was that of an ox, and the face in back was an eagle's. In Jerome's interpretation of Ezekiel's dream, the human face represented the rational part of man, the lion reflected the emotions, the ox symbolized the appetites, and the lofty eagle was that spark of conscience which was not quenched even in the heart of Cain, that makes us, too, feel our sinfulness when we are overcome by evil desire or unbridled spirit. And yet, in some men, we see this conscience overthrown and displaced. They have no sense of guilt or shame for their sins. Jerome's illustrious contemporary, Augustine of Hippo, agreed with Jerome concerning the nature of conscience. Augustine assured his followers that men see the moral rules written in the Book of Light, which is called truth, from which all laws are copied. But a conspicuous problem remained. Since the truth, the absolute knowledge of good and evil, is given by God to all human beings, why are all human beings not good? Why do we see this conscience overthrown and displaced in some people? And this question remained at the center of the theological discussion about conscience for many centuries. Despite the sticky wicket, the alternative suggestion, the proposal that only some people had conscience, was impossible to make, because it would have meant that by withholding the truth from a few of his servants, God himself had created evil in the world and had distributed it, in seeming randomness, among all the types and enterprises of humanity. A solution to the theological dilemma over conscience seemed to come in the 13th century, when Thomas Aquinas proposed a roundabout distinction between synderesis, St. Jerome's infallible God-given knowledge of right and wrong, and conscientia, which was comprised of mistake-prone human reason as it struggled to reach decisions about behavior. To make its choices concerning which actions to take, reason was supplied with perfect information from God, but reason itself was rather weak. In this system, fallible human decision-making, not a lack of conscience, is to blame for wrong decisions and actions. Doing wrong is simply making a mistake. In contrast, according to Aquinas, synderesis cannot err. It provides principles which do not vary, just as the laws that govern the physical universe do not vary. To apply this view to our contemporary example, when Joe remembers that his dog is without food and water, God-given innate synderesis, conscience, immediately informs him that the absolute right action is to return home and take care of the dog. Conscientia, a mental debate about how to behave, then takes this truth into consideration. The fact that Joe does not turn the car around instantaneously, but instead spends a few minutes deliberating, is the result of the natural weakness of human reason. That Joe does make the right decision in the end means, in Aquinas' scheme, that Joe's moral virtues are, through strengthened reason, developing in the right direction. Had Joe decided to let the dog go hungry and thirsty, his thereby weakened reason would have been directing his moral virtues to hell, theologically speaking. Getting down to theology's brass tacks, according to the early church fathers, 1. The rules of morality are absolute. 2. All people innately know the absolute truth. And 3. Bad behavior is the result of faulty thinking, rather than a lack of synderesis or conscience. And since we all have a conscience, if only human reason were perfect, there would be no bad behavior. And indeed, these are the three beliefs about conscience that have been held by much of the world throughout most of modern history. Their influence on the way we think about ourselves and other people, even today, is inestimable. The third belief is especially hard to let go of. Nearly a millennium after Aquinas made his pronouncement about synderesis, when someone consistently behaves in ways we find unconscionable, we call on an updated version of the weak reason paradigm. We speculate that the offender has been deprived, or that his mind is disturbed, or that his early background makes him do it. We remain extremely reluctant to propose the more straightforward explanation that either God or nature simply failed to provide him with a conscience. For several hundred years, discussions about conscience tended to center around the relationship between human reason and divinely given moral knowledge. A few corollary debates were added, most recently the one over proportionalism, a divine loophole wherein reason asks us to do something bad in order to bring about something else that is good, a just war, for example. But at the beginning of the 20th century, conscience itself underwent a fundamental transformation due to the growing acceptance in Europe and the United States of the theories of physician, scientist, and atheist, Sigmund Freud. Freud proposed that in the normal course of development, young children's minds acquired an internalized authority figure called a superego that would in time replace the actual external authority, the actual external authority being not God, but one's own human parents. With his discovery of the superego, Freud effectively wrested conscience out of the hands of God and placed it in the anxious clutches of the all-too-human family. This change of address for conscience required some daunting shifts in our centuries-old worldview. Suddenly, our moral guides had feet of clay, and absolute truth began to submit to the uncertainties of cultural relativism. Freud's new structural model of the mind did not involve a human part, a lion part, an ox part, and an ego. Tripartite, instead, his vision was of the superego, the ego, and the id. The id was composed of all the sexual and unthinking aggressive instincts we are born with, along with the biological appetites. As such, the id was often in conflict with the demands of a civilized society. In contrast, the ego was the rational, aware part of the mind. It could think logically, make plans, and remember. And because the ego was equipped in these ways, it could interact directly with society and, to varying degrees, get things done for the more primitive id. The superego grew out of the ego as the child incorporated the external rules of his or her parents and of society. The superego eventually became a freestanding force in the developing mind, unilaterally judging and directing the child's behaviors and thoughts. It was the commanding, guilt-brandishing inner voice that said no, even when nobody was around. The basic concept of superego makes common sense to us. We often observe children internalizing and even enforcing their parents' rules. Mother frowns and says to her 4-year-old daughter, "No shouting in the car." A few minutes later, the same 4-year-old points imperiously at her noisy 2-year-old sister and shouts, "No shouting in the car." And most of us, as adults, have heard our own superego. Some of us hear it quite often, in fact. It is a voice in our heads that says to us, "Idiot, why'd you do that?" Or, "You know, if you don't finish this report tonight, you'll be sorry." Or, "You'd better get your cholesterol checked." And in the story of Joe and Reebok, Joe's decision to miss his meeting could easily have been made by his superego. For purposes of illustration, let us speculate that Joe's pet withholding father used to say to him when he was 4, "No, little Joey, we can't get a dog." A dog is a tremendous responsibility. When you have a dog, you always have to interrupt what you're doing and take care of it. Joe's adult decision to turn his car around could well have been directed by his superego, which insisted that he fulfill this very dictum. In a more obtuse manner, Freud himself might have wondered whether Joe's superego had caused Joe to set up his whole morning, unconsciously, of course, being in too much of a hurry, forgetting to put out the dog food, such that his father's rule could be proved and Joe punished for getting a pet. For in Freudian theory, the superego is not just a voice, it is an operator, a subtle and complex manipulator, a prover of points. It prosecutes, judges, and carries out sentences, and it does all this quite outside of our conscious awareness. While the superego, in the best case, can help the individual get along in society, it can also become the most overbearing and perhaps the most destructive part of his personality. According to psychoanalysts, an especially harsh superego, hammering away inside someone's head, can create a lifelong depression or even propel its poor victim into suicide. And so Freud introduced the world to the decidedly secular notion that conscience might need to be repaired in some people, and that through psychoanalysis, one might actually repair it. In addition, more shocking still, Freud and his followers linked the final establishment of the superego to the child's resolution of the Oedipus complex. The Oedipus complex, sometimes called the Electra complex in girls, is formed when the young child begins to realize, between the ages of 3 and 5, that he or she will never completely possess the parent of the opposite sex. In prosaic terms, boys must accept that they will not marry their mothers, and girls must accept that they will not marry their fathers. Oedipal struggles and the resulting feelings of competition, fear, and resentment toward the parent of the same sex are so powerful and dangerous to the child's family relationships, according to Freud, that they must be thoroughly repressed or kept from awareness, and this repression is made possible by a drastic strengthening of the young superego. From this point on, should any sexual feelings arise toward the parent of the opposite sex, or any rivalrous feelings toward the parent of the same sex, these feelings will be vanquished by the dreaded, ruthless weapon of the newly fortified superego, immediate, unbearable guilt. In this way, the superego gains its autonomy and its crowning advantage inside the mind of the child. It is a severe taskmaster installed to serve our need to remain a part of the group. Whatever else one might think of such theorizing, credit must be given to Freud for understanding that our moral sense was not a one-size-fits-all hermetic code, but was instead dynamic and intricately tied up with essential family and societal bonds. With his writings on the superego, Freud imparted to an awakening scientific world that our usual respect for law and order was not simply imposed on us from the outside. We obey the rules, we honor the virtues, primarily from an internal need that begins in infancy and early childhood to preserve and remain embraced by our families and the larger human society in which we live. Conscience versus superego. Whether or not one believes that superego is an intrapsychic schemer, or that it is, to use Freud's words, the heir to the Oedipus complex, superego itself must be acknowledged as a rich and useful concept. As an inner voice acquired through our significant childhood relationships, commenting on our shortcomings and railing against our transgressions, superego is a feature of subjective experience that most people recognize easily. Don't do that. You shouldn't feel that way. Be careful you hurt yourself. Be nice to your sister. Clean up that mess you made. You can't afford to buy that. Well, that wasn't very smart, was it? You've just got to deal with it. Stop wasting time. Superego yammers at us inside our minds every day of our lives, and some people's superegos are rather more insulting than others. Still, superego is not the same thing as conscience. It may feel like conscience, subjectively, and may be one small part of what conscience is, but superego by itself is not conscience. This is because Freud, as he conceptualized the superego, threw out the baby with the bathwater, in a manner of speaking. In ejecting moral absolutism from psychological thought, he counted out something else, too. Quite simply, Freud counted out love, and all of the emotions related to love. Though he often stated that children love their parents in addition to fearing them, the superego he wrote about was entirely fear-based. In his view, just as we fear our parents' stern criticisms when we are children, so do we fear the excoriating voice of superego later on. And fear is all. There is no place in the Freudian superego for the conscience-building effects of love, compassion, tenderness, or any of the more positive feelings. And conscience, as we have seen in Joe and Reebok, is an intervening sense of obligation based in our emotional attachments to others, all aspects of our emotional attachments, including, most especially, love, compassion, and tenderness. In fact, the seventh sense in those individuals who possess it is primarily love and compassion based. We have progressed over the centuries from faith in a God-directed synderesis to a belief in a punitive parental superego, to an understanding that conscience is deeply and affectingly anchored in our ability to care about one another.